Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. That's the traditional introduction to the talk. And the title of this talk was September 11th, The View from the Monastery. I'm sure. Now, we don't have TVs and media and so forth in the monastery, so September 11th is not, I'm sure you've had your add up to here with September 11th, probably. So, but I thought I'd give you, you probably haven't heard what it, the view from the monastery is. You've probably heard every other kind of view of it. So, I thought I would start with something, and just our view of the whole thing. I heard about September 11th on September 11th, which is interesting. As I say, we don't have radios going and TVs going and updates on news or newspapers, and we basically hear the news of the world through word of mouth. And it's interesting that basically all these sort of important stories appear very quickly by word of mouth. You don't really have to listen to any media to know what's going on. When I was in Thailand, in the most remote forest monasteries, I heard all about that the U.S. was going to war, the Gulf War in the U.S., and I also heard that that Russia had fallen apart, and those were the two. Probably the major stories that was in the early 1990s, 1991 or two, and that arrived through a Thai novice told me that and there was some basic discussion, how long is this going to last, and then basically what do you remember from 10 years back in terms you were exposed to. Radio, TVs, magazines, newspaper, you probably had it up to here with all of the stuff about the Gulf War and then Russia falling apart. What else do you remember about 1992? You had access to all this media, thousands of hours probably went into your head. What do you remember? Remember anything else? That's what I remember, and I only took two sentences to tell me that. And as far as the details go, well, not much, eh? I know it lasted about a month or, the Americans lost very few, etc. What do you remember? In terms of the actual news, it's interesting to just reflect on media and what the overkill and the over-information. And in the end, what do you really know? You remember probably about what I know about it. And it was just a brief transference of news by word of mouth. September 11th, I was standing out in front of the monastery, which was under construction. I think I just walked out of we had a cell phone tied to the chimney of the monastery in a shaky kind of way, and we only got bad reception. Somebody handed me this cell phone, and it was a woman, a Vietnamese woman from Seattle named Karuna, which means compassion. And she said, "Oh, Bhante, I'm so glad you're building that monastery. I'm watching TV here. They blew up the World Trade Center." And she didn't say who or anything like that. Just she was watching it at that moment. Phoned me up just congratulate. Just that she was she's retired, and she had actually spent time working for the World Bank and in New York City. And she and her sister lived together, Metta and Karuna. Loving kindness and compassion lived together there. So compassion called me up and told me that they'd blown up the World Trade Center, and she was just made her so glad that we were building this monastery. And so at first it didn't mean very much to me. I said, I have been there actually. I've been up on the observation deck of the World Trade Center, spent some time hanging around at the elevators at the bottom at rush hour. As deliberately, I went there with a friend back in the 70s when I when I was savoring the high culture of North America, I used to go to New York City. I'll tell you more about that later. He's one of the things, he was a Canadian that had moved there, and he was just overwhelmed by the kind of the population and everything there. He said one of the interesting things is to go down to the escalators at the bottom of the World Trade Center. Well, we first went up to the top, and he's got a fear of heights, so he wouldn't go near the observation window. I got to look over it. And he told me that the building sways about 6 feet in the wind, you know, and so forth, and it does. And so, you know, and you zing up in the elevator, you lose, you know, you feel a little bit dizzy, and it goes up so fast. And then he said, "This is great. You just watch this. When about 5 o'clock, you stand at the bottom. There's 12 escalators come down here. 35,000 people will walk past you in about 20 minutes. You just stand right between the escalators and just watch this." Army of just people in business suits and so forth just flooding past you. So we did. Interesting experience. So all of this came back to me. Oh, yes, the World Trade Center. Well, not so big. Who blew it up? You know, she didn't say. Of course, nobody knew at the time what was going on. So that was my... Then the electrician showed up. And he sort of filled in a little bit more of the story. And so we just picked it up by word of mouth, people showing up. So, but it took a few days, and I started to think, hey, you know, that's the World Trade Center right downtown New York. They blew it. They drove an airplane. That must be just, that's really something. It kind of slowly got bigger and bigger in my mind. I realized, wow, that is something. Really something. So I started to think and reflect, you know, what it meant. I think, in general, my instinct is that I probably thought the way most of my generation, I'm a baby boomer, tend to think that we're all a little bit apocalyptic. We had a sense, and many of the songs from the 60s are about, I remember one specific titled, called The Eve of Destruction. And the refrain, that the repetitive thing was, you tell me over and over and over again that you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. And the song just goes through thing after thing after Vietnam War, the nuclear bombs, one thing after another, and you tell me at the end of this that you don't believe that we're on the eve of destruction. That was very resonant with my generation. We had this feeling, and it might have had something to do with being in grade 2 and being shown how to get under your desk in case a nuclear bomb dropped. I don't know what good that would do, but I was asking my father whether he had sandbags for the basement, you know, the nuclear shelter and all this kind of stuff. So it might have had something to do with that. There's always that feeling like, oh yes, okay, maybe this is it, maybe this is the beginning of it. But this the other feeling that I have is kind of searching around and asking myself, how's everybody handling this? Without talking to too many people about it. And my feeling was, and which was confirmed over a period of time, was that this generation, post-Second World War generation, particularly of North American generation, lots of people in this room weren't raised in North America, and their psychology may not be the same, but basically my feeling is that the generation, baby boomer generation, is psychologically fragile, has not got as intact as a psychology as the generation up to the Second World War, before the baby boomers. That the psychology of people then was more solid. They were able to endure experiences with greater stability and less trauma. They went through the First World War, Second World War, which were far exceeded the Vietnam War in terms of destruction, and you know, it went on for years of, you know, very terrible combat, and they came out more psychologically intact. What we saw, very ominous with the Vietnam War, was very little capacity to handle the traumas of the war and part of the American soldiers that were over there, fragmenting or much less, and they were over there for much shorter terms than the Second World War soldiers, very short. So there's something, what was falling away at the same time is a central vision in the culture of the meaning of life and how, what you're supposed to, the attitude towards life. Now, before that, it was basically informed by a religious kind of spiritual basis that this is a temporary kind of passage and that you will, you know, get relief after this life. There's something to endure through this life. And that whole notion was falling away very rapidly after the Second World War. That this was it, and you progress, and you also progress itself, like in science, in health, and inoculations, and people longevity going up. It gives you a lot of false hope, and tends to weaken vision. So, what I felt was there's this a saying from the Old Testament. Where there is no vision, the people perish. It is vision that allows a culture to be resilient and able to handle difficult situations. But what I felt was that this generation was very uncertain whether what to do, or whether they had the stuff to deal with a difficult situation. They were very preoccupied with the economy. What happens if we can't maintain all of our comforts? I wouldn't want to try to deal with any kind of level of discomfort or deprivation. This generation has never done that since my birth. I mean, the wealth has just steadily, it's the wealthiest and most the least amount of discomfort, I think, in any generation on the face of the earth. The average middle class person lives about as well as a king lived in the Renaissance, and perhaps more. They have at their disposal all the comforts and more of a Renaissance king to the average person. This makes a psychology is very uncertain about what they could put up with without a hard to deal with any sense of deprivation. A lack of patience, a lack of endurance, a lack of one of his primal virtues, patient endurance, which the Buddha says is the highest of virtues. This is of the 10 perfections, the highest is patient endurance. This is what really, in the end, will get you through, patient endurance. A great lack of self-confidence in the culture. I also think that, in general, people, what happens with an event like that has very little to do with, what does it have to do with British Columbia or Ontario? It's a long ways away, very localized event. But people, that's not the way it occurs to people. It becomes a personal event. And what is brought up is your vulnerabilities. So, and some of you may have experienced it as well, that when something like that happens, first of all, it's shocking that it's just so vulnerable and open. The United States, this huge military power, you're told all the time that they're the ones that, you know, really are running the world now, the empire, and that they got all this super duper space technology and, you know, all these super duper weapons, and then somebody. It just, all of that is just shattered by the fact that you can just take two airplanes and just run them into these major skyscrapers and just drop the whole thing to the ground without them even any kind of ability to defend against that, or it all completely surprised by it. It's just a very simple and easy thing to do. It just the vulnerability, and this is probably this is, I'm sure this is what Americans felt, and Canadians sort of took on that identity for a while, is that we're completely vulnerable. And what that brings up in your own life is how also vulnerable you are, and how it tends to bring up all of the negative things as well that happened to you in your life. I found people bringing up the fragilities of childhood and things that had happened to them, along memories surfacing for people of traumatic things that have happened to them in their personal life somewhere far away. And it could be on a very, just somebody bullied them at school, you know. And somehow this event of the dropping of the World Trade Center brings up this fragility that's ordinarily suppressed, because we're told again and again, you know, how stable things are, and we're told by the media, and then it turns out to be false, and we tend to live in a false world of reassurances, self-reassurances all the time. This is why the five subjects for frequent reflection or frequent recollection by the Buddha is: remember that you are fragile and are vulnerable. You're subject to aging, loss, death, illness, and the loss of all things that are stabilizing and beloved to you. And that all you have for stability is your own good deeds. And that your negative deeds are also part of your baggage as well. So that you take the Buddha's, this is vision. This is why if you do this, if you understand a responsibility for your actions, cause and effect, that you will have a vision that sustains you in these things, because it won't be a surprise that you're vulnerable, that things are vulnerable, that you're subject to loss and so forth. But the entire culture never recollects that. They always, in a strange way, despite the fact that they see, you know, how many murders does a kid see by the time they're 20, like on TV, and it's always a fantasy. What's so shocking is that such a thing could actually be. So this is the antidote to this, is to how one has to cultivate a sense of vision, and that's the only thing that this culture has everything else, but it has no vision, and so that fragility becomes very personal. So whenever they see this, again, just very recently, and again, you probably heard it up to here, this, but the sniper thing in Washington, this very interesting situation as well. What's interesting about it is, how does this guy keep, it's like, how do they just keep doing this without getting caught? Where there's just like thousands of people looking for them, and that sort of, you're under the impression that there's a certain amount of law and order, some sort of control over this, but it's obvious, very obvious, that they can hardly do anything about this. Now I learned Ajahn Vee is my news source today. I get the news by word of mouth. So we went for a walk today. Now he's looking after his mother, and she's got CNN on all the time. But he can't help it. It's just like he can't get away from it. And it's played 100 times, you know, and it's just thousands of times. So he summarizes it up for me. And again, probably I know as much as you now. In two sentences, you probably heard this coming out your ears. I've heard two sentences, I probably know as much about it as you. You know? And this is the terrible nature of media. There's hardly any content to it at all. These guys, a couple of yokels, you know, just ordinary fools, and just not any particular plan, but clever enough to get into the trunk of the car and shoot out of that, you know. And that's all it took. And the FBI and the the military and the police and everybody else, couldn't do anything about it. This also makes you realize this security and control is all an illusion. It's all, basically, law and order is a voluntary agreement. It really can't be enforced. And it's just because most people are reasonably decent and volunteer to abide by the law that the law is kept. But if anybody actually decides not to, it's very, very difficult to enforce it. They say that murder is one of the easiest things to get away with in crime statistics. Very few, it's not a lot of murderers are caught. So this is a sense of fragility and vulnerability, which these events are. Why do they fascinate us? Because it is this quality of, hey, this is telling me a different story than I ordinarily tell myself, that I ordinarily feel. It feels orderly. This society, you know, I walk around, it feels orderly. But it's, and I trust that order, and I trust that all of this, everything's being stabilized somewhere. Some people are in charge here, aren't they? And then you get information like this, these events that tell you, no, actually, it's just, if anybody actually decided to do anything, there's hardly anything you can do about it. It just shows you again this fragility, vulnerability, insecurity. And this is what strongly this generation is not prepared to deal with. They have not integrated this. So I see, you know, a lot of people I talk to are stressed as well and don't handle it too well. Just before I came out in Kamloops, you may have even heard this news nationally. Kamloops is a small town where the monastery is just south of it, but 35 minutes south of it in the forest. And this fellow worked for the Ministry of Environment, of all things, and he had received a reprimand. He's a man, 55 years old, went into his, and he'd been overstressed because the government is on a budget, so he was sort of taking care of a couple people's jobs or doing more than he needed. So he got this, he went home, got a gun, came back and shot two of his co-workers. These guys are all in their 40s or 50s, and then shot himself. Interesting response to a reprimand, you know, letter. I wonder what's going on there. It was also very shocking, surprising to people. I was very surprised that a lot of local people would mention this to me again and again. I even came out on the plane, and the person beside me said, I said, Kamloops, oh yeah, that's the place where that guy, you know, yeah. It's very interesting that it kind of registers like this, we're just sitting on the edge of something very explosive and very undealt with. The whole culture is sitting on that, and every time these things happen, it brings up some sort of personal thing. Now, of course, most of the people in this room have been making an effort to cultivate vision, and cultivate the sense of being in touch with that reality of the fragility, transience, and out-of-control nature of reality. Now, that's important, that particular phrase. That is the highest and most relevant teaching of the Buddha. And this is given in his first sermon in the Deer Park, and his second sermon particularly. This is... what the essence of it is not self. And another way of talking about non-self is how you get to understand non-self or not self is through lack of control. The Buddha points out that you don't have control, for instance, over your body. You can't command it. It doesn't do what you tell it to. You don't have much control over your environment. You can't command it. It won't do what you tell it to. You discover by questioning yourself about what do you own, what do you control, that you just don't control or own much, and it's ownership, a sense of owning and controlling that gives you a sense of identity. And in fact, these events are over ownership and control. Why did the guy shoot himself, etc.? He just he was completely at the end of his rope about control. He realized he had no control over anything. He'd been given a reprimand. He's trying his best. He's trying to get things under control. It snapped. Why did they drop these towers? Threat to ownership and control. And why would they drop the World Trade Center? Because it's all about ownership and control. They knew very, very well that the trade centers are the symbols of ownership and control. The essence of the teaching of the Buddha is to realize you're not in control, and that if you pay attention to this in a proper way, it is a liberating truth. Because if you walk around thinking you're in control when you're not, then reality will be very shattering to you when it demonstrates in a very visible way that you're not in control. So the sense of that vulnerability that people experience when they're slapped in the face with the very truth that the society, their defense mechanisms, all these things it's not controlled at all, it's out of control, is what disturbs everybody at their core. The Buddha is saying, if you are just waiting for a fall, if you don't deal with this often and remind yourself of this lack of ownership and control, it is this very simple, just utterly simple truth about, and is the essence of the nature of identity. Who am I? I define myself by what I own. A sense of ownership is about people as well. That's my child, my uncle, my family, my country, etc. You build an identity by a sense of extending yourself to the things around you. The Buddha is saying you don't even really control your own mind, as we know when we try to meditate. We see how intractably out of control the thing is. And yet we even have the audacity to claim that that's my husband. He's out of control, of course, but even your own mind is not, there for command or control. And yet, the Buddha is saying, it's counterintuitive. We kind of deny this, and there's a lot of reinforcement to these notions of ownership and control, but it is the fundamental anxiety at the core of our life when these things are threatened, and there always are, because they aren't stable, aren't in control. So we should realize the benefit that the Buddha is encouraging us. And of course, we're a little bit fearful of this, is the unknown. When we explain to ourselves on a regular basis, and that is what reflection is and recollection is, that just go through it systematically. Just remind yourself, I don't own and control my body. I didn't make the thing. I don't own and control my mind. I didn't make the thing. I don't control the economy. I don't control my family, etc. It's and then with this truth itself is causes a profound sense of ease and relaxation, because what vanishes is not control. The delusion of control vanishes, and with the delusion of control, the delusion of controller vanishes. The controller is the sense of self. And things come back to the way they really are. They're certainly lawful and precise, meaningful, but they are not. There is nobody that's, especially you, that is running the show. I talked about it today with people. That very beautiful Chinese saying from the Tao Te Ching: "Give up running the universe." It's very nice. I read that sentence, made a lot of impact on me years and years ago. Give up running the universe. I laughed for a while. I thought, of course that's what we all do, isn't it? We're all trying to run the universe. That's the tension of running the universe. It's a very big responsibility, isn't it? Huh? It just takes up so much of our time running the universe. It's just such a burden on us to run this universe, to object to this, to make this to demand that it goes this way and that way and so forth. It's just so tiring. Sometimes we wish we would just be like those other people out there. I'd look at people sort of lying on the sidewalk, being irresponsible and so forth. And, oh, I wish I was like them. I just can't give up running the universe. You know, I've got to run this thing. You know, so, of course, that's not the way out. Just be to take a drink. There's an interesting saying that I came across in Bartlett's quotations, which is, there are two things which will be believed about any man whatsoever, and one of these is that he has taken to drink. Mm-hmm. I said, why would that be? No. Because you just realize, just the weariness of running the universe must be overwhelming. You know, it's just every man is trying to run the universe. Every woman is trying to run the universe. And sometimes it's just so easy to understand why one would take to drink. What the other thing is, I'll leave it up to your imagination. I don't know what it is. That is the nature of good literature. They say things like that. So this matter of control and ownership is a big problem. And how do we get out of it? There's a story. This is not from a Buddhist monk story, but it's from Christian monks of the 4th century AD. And these are called the Desert Fathers. And they lived in a very similar way to the forest monks. They left organized institutional religion in the cities, which was drifting, and they went to the forests or the deserts at that time in North Africa, and they lived out there. And so what they said, when you read their sayings, they sound like Ajahn Chahs out there. They sound like the Zen masters and the forest monks. They speak in the same way. There's a little story about these two monks lived out, and they shared a cell. And they'd been at it for a long, been monks for a long time. They never had an argument. So one of them says, "Tita, you know, people out there in the world, they have these arguments." He says, "Yes, yes. You know, we should have an argument." "Yes, okay, let's have an argument. So how do you go about it?" "So, well, apparently they argue over things. So let's say this brick here. Now I'll put this brick in the middle of the room, and I'll say that's mine. Now you say it's yours, and then I'll say it's mine." You say, "Okay, let's do it." So he put the brick down. He says, "This brick is mine." And then the hermit says, it's mine. "No, it's mine." And he said, "It's mine." And then the first one says, "Well, if it's yours, then have it." So in the end, they were unable to start an argument with each other. So it comes down to, isn't it? Is it more complicated than that? Are there subtleties beyond that? Is that not why all of this, what, from nations to individuals, is it over? Something like that. It's mine and it's yours, but you won't say, "Well, if it's yours, then take it." You know. Now, what's so interesting and funny about this is that, of course, it's a brick, and it just, you know, it's valueless. But they didn't have anything that more value that they could come up with, you know. That's all they had. And actually, they were quite happy. They never argued, you see. And so they were able to, and they often lived long and happy lives. But it's when we have a bunch of stuff that we can, you know, we just sit it down in the middle of the room, and then somebody says, "It's mine," and they say, "Oh, it's mine," and it's back and forth. So I have to. It's about ownership, isn't it? It's that, and nothing else. And when you have ownership, you have an owner. And actually, the owner is the problem. The owner is the delusion and the problem. And it's no more profound than that. Why nations go to war is no more than what, just a simple argument over something like that. The sense of ownership, it just never occurs to people. Question this. Why did they do that? Why did they drop the World Trade Center? Did they do it just for fun or anything like that. No. They had reasons, and the reasons had to have roots in ownership, a quarrel over ownership, and I'm sure we all suspect it. You know, they resented the American attempt to own things, and they felt that they owned it, etc. Now, I'm not saying either of them is right. They're both wrong, but at the root of it all is the owner idea. The owner idea. And the Buddha is saying, look, if you want any personal peace, it is by seeing through this ownership. It is not by giving up ownership. It is by realizing the lack of ownership. So renunciation or giving things up is not really about letting go or giving things up. It is about realizing that you'd never had them to begin with. And that's all. It isn't anything other than that. It's just the realization of what do you own, what do you control, what is yours. When you really go into it, nothing. And what is there to give up? There's no threat to your property or anything like that. That's just their explanation that you don't own it. There's nothing to let go of. There's nothing to get. You're in this situation. And it's just that truth is the kind of the central truth which resolves, which all of these other virtues and everything come out of, that realization. Let's just leave these few reflections with you tonight about September 11th, viewed from the monastery. That's the way I view it, what I think about it. I will, of course, if anybody wants to make any comments or ask any questions, that's quite all right. Yes.
So on stage about wonder, deity, and fragility are very much point. Whatever you like to comment, it has been stated by some that when we compare our lives or society today with the past and the lives of people in the past, one observation has been the increasing complexity of life, and that the observation has been made that complexity by itself has as a necessary concomitant a tendency to it of being more, making it more vulnerable. So would the vulnerability arise from that, in that our lives have become more complex? And presumably making our lives simpler in terms of what we surround ourselves might make us less vulnerable.
Yes, this of course is one of the teachings, one of the notions of the Buddha is simplify. Beautiful saying by Thoreau, one of my favorites, just simplify. I took this very much to heart and in my life, and I found it's a very absorbing process, and it is kind of in a nutshell or in a word, it is a summary of the entire Eightfold Path. What is it? It is a movement towards simplicity. What is also truth? Truth is, in a sense, it's like a beautiful mathematical expression. It is the when you can capture all the conditions in the least number of words or symbols, which adequately cover all the possibilities. And so it is, truth is a movement towards simplicity. And this is the, one of the things we know, we remark about genius. If we listen to Mozart or Bach or something, one of the peculiar things that resonate with a person, especially if they're musically sensitive and they listen to it for a long time, what's the staggering genius about it is that there's not one note extra and there's not one note missing. It's exactly enough. And this is the, in a sense, the expression of truth, just enough. The expression by the Buddha of Four Noble Truths is just a beautiful, it's enough and it's not too much of the essence of things. So it is simplicity itself, and the movement towards simplicity is kind of a movement towards truth. And as you come towards this central truth, ultimate simplicity is that there's no, in a sense, non-duality. Is the complexity arises when you separate yourself off from the world, and you are in a relationship with it. This is the creation of at least two. Now you can get it simpler than that. When you let go of self, it dissolves many of the problems. The complexity arises around this fundamental. What is it that causes the complexity to begin with? It is the sense of self and ownership and control. And after that, what do we do all day? What do engineers do all day? They devise systems to control things. I mean, you know, to get this thing under control. The idea of progress. Progress towards what, though? Often, as I say, we often complicate things. We're trying to get it simpler, but it seems to complicate things. And you can see this is one of the other statistics that when I was reading about the difference, the crime rate of teenagers from 1950 to now. One of the interesting statistics was that the average working person in the mid 1930s had 40 hours of free time per week. And the average person, working man, in 1995 had 17 hours of free time per week. He somewhere in this machine, development of machines and all these things to make life easier, like power more versus. You can imagine in the 1930s, what did you do? You mowed your lawn by hand mower, etc. Somewhere along the line, we lost 23 hours of free time in all these labor-saving devices. What happens there? How did that happen? It is very strange. And with this, of course, increasing stress and a kind of running on the treadmill to keep servicing this growing complexity and these things that are supposed to be labor-saving devices. It is a very peculiar, and we can feel it in the monastery. So I sort of presumed that the last computer we had would do it. You know, I don't know. My God. So I was explained that it was at 60% capacity, and then sometimes it was starting to falter and everything. And we better get this because we had this new accounting system, and it was just necessary. And finally I said, oh, it must be necessary. You guys take care of it. I'm going. So yeah, so you can feel that sort of pull, gravitational pull into this, and demands and commands and so forth on you. It's vulnerability. That is where when Bhante Gunaratna, I'm sure you're all familiar with Bhante Gunaratna, came to the States in 1966, Washington Vihara. That was the first time Buddhist monks had established a Vihara in North America. And the when the Americans started, because the Sri Lankans have words for monks, a title for monks, and but they had to come up with a new. The Americans asked, "So how do what do we call you?" And so they were thinking about like Bhante is a Pali word from the text. Like the Sri Lankans really don't in Sri Lanka, Bhante is not really the term of address. It's something else. And in Thailand, it's not Bhante either. It's they have Thai words for this, and every culture has already got cultural words for their. So we're not really monks either. We're not priests. The Sri Lankans tend to have this British-y kind of thing about we call it calling me a priest. Well, I'm not a priest at all. It's a very misleading kind of word. So they tried. There's also a bit of a British influence in Sri Lanka. So they tried venerable. So it was at least an English word. I think they looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, sort of. And they came up with venerable. So they said to people asked them, okay, what should we call you? We'll call us venerable. Well, Americans don't use that word. That's a very British kind of thing. So they said, vulnerable to what? So I like that, you know. Vulnerable sir. This is good to remind yourself, you know, vulnerable sir. As long as you have a self to any degree, you are a vulnerable sir. Anybody else have any concluding?
The point that you stressed was this point about control. One of the things that has kept driving ever since the 18th century the main force, the main impulse behind the scientific enterprise has been the sense that it gives control. Mm-hmm. I wonder how this posits with Buddhist view that really one doesn't have control.
Well, again and again, that's why I would say that the psychological structure today is extremely fragile, is because of the certain amount of for that what sustained the whole culture were religious visions, which always were ways of dealing with the fact that the things were obviously very out of control and disease was rampant and you couldn't do anything about it and all kinds of stuff. But obviously they didn't get it under control in the 20th century, but it seemed like there might be the possibility of this, and then everybody tended to buy it a little bit too soon. And with that, right away, is a dropping of the old system of dealing with it, which seemed to be rather pessimistic and oriented towards another world rather than this world. But with that orientation was an acceptance of the fact that this is in the Christian terms, a veil of tears, a valley of tears, and that you are when you face that and you walk through it in a kind of but you're to have faith and strength while you walk through this valley of tears. Now, that notion falls away, and it's a valley of mega superstores. It's a valley of TV and good times and beer advertisements and stuff like that. That's what it's a valley of, and. So, with that, your capacity to deal with when it turns out not true is very limited. So the Buddha, again, he's saying, well, five subjects for frequent recollection. illness, aging, death, loss of all that is beloved, and in the midst of it, remembering responsibility for your actions. That is what your inheritance is your own actions. So it's a kind of a revert. By strangely enough, that kind of pessimistic truth is very lightening up. After all, it's you stop worrying, so it's not going to last very long, and you lighten up about the whole thing. It's not a and what's important in it is the goodness of your acts. So it's not really whether you succeed or fail. It's just the accumulation of good actions, which are your success. Your success is in you can do that. In any situation, even as when you're ill or dying, all it takes is a moment of thought of goodwill for profound repercussions to go with you. So the other types of success are just the fact that society is praising and demanding certain types of success on the media, on all levels of media. These things are not possible. You can't just command to be famous. You know, you want to be famous. You go to New York. They even have whole movies about this. Oh, he's a good, obscure person from Wisconsin, goes to New York, becomes famous. You know? It's as if this is commandable or something, this could happen, etc. Of course, it's a very, very rare thing. It's very obviously very karmic. You know, it's peculiar. People are selected out of millions in strange ways, and it just this is the nature of karma rather than control. How do you become successful? Is that funny story actually? It's kind of Buddhist in a way. The conflict, this American explanation of success is we're wealthy and successful because skill, you know, brains and know-how, and skills. That's why we're successful. And so there's a folk singer from the 40s and 50s named Pete Seeger. A nice kind of wit to that sort of... the folk movement was a comment, had some comment on society. He tells a story about two dung beetles on a sidewalk, and they're talking to each other in the sunshine and about this and that, and then a street sweeper comes along, sweeps up the both into a dustpan, and when he's walking along, one of them falls out into a gutter, and there's nothing to eat down there. He's having trouble getting out of there. The other one, he's carried off and dumped on a pile of horse manure, which is very, it's like being dumped into heaven for a dung beetle. So then they're in there for, they don't see each other for days, and finally they get out of their respect, they're wandering around one day and they meet. And the guy that got dumped into the gutter is skinny and not in good health and deprived of everything, and he meets the other guy, sleek and fat and waddling down the sidewalk and everything. And, well, I haven't seen you for a long time. Wow. So the skinny beetle says to him, well, you know what, how come you're so sleek and fat? And he says, brains and skills, my friend, brains and skills. And this is, you know, when you, what really happened to be dumped into the middle of the pristine wilderness of North America that the aboriginals had kept in pristine condition, and then to mine it all out and cut everything down and etc. and sell it to everybody. There's brains and skills, friend. That's why we're so fat and rich and happy, is brains and skills. We just got dumped on a dung heap. So these, you know, this explanation for success and apparent, you know, control and all this kind of stuff is tends to be, you know, wildly exaggerated, and every now and then it blows up in your face, and you're kind of in a kind of embarrassed way. You know, the 10,000 FBI agents all chasing their tails, and a couple of, you know, half-wits in the back of a car pinning everybody down for, you know, in the nation's capital. Kind of every now and then, this kind of comedy, tragic comedy appears and you just see the futility and how unskillful and out of control it all is. You know? And every now and then these utterly absurd events occur that keep telling us that we are not brains and skill. You know, it's just a kind of, you know, it's you just got dumped in the middle of some good fortune, that's all.
We all seem to be part of this brains and skills society.
Mm-hmm.
Without being part of it, we seem to be, we will be way behind.
Yeah.
Any idea as to how we can balance this, or is it possible at all?
Well, that's part of the you know, the problem about the brains and the skills. Like, it's just, it's an infectious disease. It traps you and pulls you into it, and everybody's all caught in the circle. And it's hard to, you know, you can't exist without email after a while, and you know, one thing after another after another after another, and your whole car is computerized. You can't fix a thing anymore yourself. You can't. You just, you know. My father was pretty good, you know, he'd never trained mechanic, but I was always amazed when I was a teenager, something would be wrong with the car, and he'd open the hood, and the hose is unclamped, you know, clamp the hose on. I said, wow, how do you learn about that? How do you know? It was, actually, if you look in a car's engine, and I wasn't that type, I was a kind of artsy type, you know, but it's not that complicated, you know, but you could fix it then. But now you can't, you know, and you've got to go there. They've got a diagnostic something thing that they plug into this thing, and this guy's, you know, where's he been? He's MIT or something. He's not a mechanic anymore. He's, he doesn't know how it works either. It's just, but what, it's just a kind of a labyrinth of complexity, you know, and so forth. And this falling behind, too, is... nobody really knows. It's all moving very fast. What's this Nortel thing? Maybe that'll be the talk tomorrow night. Nortel, the view from the monastery. there are ways. I mean, one of the things is it's all, but you, when you think, the apparatus that is doing the thinking. Remember, if it's all sped up, it will tend to come out with a picture of itself, the thing that you use to think. Now remember, so the Buddha says, before you think, don't use that thing that's already all sped up to strategize with and make plans and evaluate. like in the Boy Scout manual, you know, when you get lost, what's the first thing you do? You start thinking? No. Yeah, sit down. Yeah. Don't start moving around. Don't try to get up, but sit down. Or on the fire alarm information, before they tell you to do anything, so calm down. So before you start thinking, the thing that you do the planning with, you have to first of all slow it down, and then it will start to a lot of the problems, instead of being solved, will be dissolved. Right? You'll recognize that a lot of these things are not problems to begin with. It's the very speed of the mind itself that creates the problems, you know. And it's in your best moments, in your lucid moments, in your calm moments, there isn't a problem. And then when it speeds up, there's so many problems they're so complex that it's you can't even start to solve them. What's happening there? There's a little trick going on. The mind itself spinning that fast is the thing that generates the problems. And when the mind settles down and becomes still, it can address these problems. So that's what the solutions the Buddha came up with were preceded by stillness, preceded by serenity. And as he points out, serenity and insight always go hand in hand. You cannot separate insight or wisdom from serenity. It is necessary to cultivate serenity, calmness, clarity before using the apparatus that solves the problem. And when they are separated, which we have done to some degree in this society, exaggerated the problem-solving side of the brain. I remember being sort of harassed by the teacher from grade one about, now what's the answer to this problem, and what's the answer to that problem, and then when you just solve that problem, they have another one for you, and you just go all the way through, you know, right up to the end of the university. They're just constantly handing you problems, and you get marked on how many times you volunteer to deal with the problem. This tends to produce one side of the brain, but they don't have a period in school where you just say, now I want you, everybody, just sit there quietly, just close your eyes, be calm. I'm not going to do anything. That's missing. So we tend to get it's as if we were weightlifting on one arm only, you know, and we got the other one is dangling flaccid by our side, and the other one is enormously overdeveloped. So it's all very good to have this apparatus, but it only works properly when it is balanced by the other capacity. That is stability, serenity, clarity. And then the apparatus for solving problems is properly balanced. It is at the service, but if it's, it tends to be, it is a servant of peace. The capacity, intelligence, and problem-solving abilities are what are they to serve? To serve your life, and to serve the servant of your own peace, your sense of peace. Peace of mind. But unfortunately, the servant has taken over the house and runs the whole house and only serves to increase its own power and admiration. So these are these things have to be kept in order. So you are now serving machines, aren't you? You're chasing around serving the speed of machines. Instead of them, the idea was that they were going to serve you. Remember that? That was the idea back in 1930. Now you're all just, servants of these things. So I think we'll, now it seems to be 8:43. I believe I started around roughly 7 o'clock. So, we will call it a night for the Dhamma discussions.